You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Do, 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 do. It's episode 300. And coming up this week, when I was a teenage tour manager for Chuck Berry. It wasn't good. How sports hierarchies take you and me for granted. And John Lydon. Shut up, mate, would ya? It's all coming up after Chaka Khan and one of the greatest intros in pop history, Ain't Nobody. One of the most blissful intros of all time, call it funk, call it R&B, call it disco, I call it out as one of the greatest pop songs of all time. Only a limited hit when it was released. Number 22 in the US, number 8 in the UK from 1983. Chaka Khan with Rufus and Ain't Nobody.
It's such a tune. She was on later with Jules Holland, the Hootenanny this year.
Was she?
And was really good. There were various the clothing that she chose to wear, which was, you know, appeared to be some kind of licorice meets PVC jumpsuit, was a bit peculiar, it has to be said. But she's still got a great voice. And if you're going to do Ain't Nobody and I'm Every Woman, they are basically the best songs ever, aren't they? So it works for me.
I'm going to have to seek out that video clip now after you've discussed it.
Absolutely. I'm taking no liability for any counselling you have. To see the results.
Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council, brought to you by the Media Motel. You will, of course, almost certainly be listening to this in one of the town parades or street parties all around the world, celebrating. This is episode 300.
Yes, indeed. We are waving from the back of the carnival float as we speak.
I'm Terence Stackham, and There Ain't Nobody makes us happy, makes us feel this way more than Juliet Harris.
You know, this is incredibly kind. You're always far too magnanimous in your introductions. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 300th party. We've got a trestle table with little pineapple and cheese on sticks, and I'm wearing a party hat.
It's a vision as always. Jules, when the death of Chuck Berry was announced last week, I initially thought, I'll keep a respectful distance, hold back on my anecdotes of possibly the worst couple of weeks of my life. But then I realised he's gone, his family have probably heard far worse, and they probably won't hear this. So here goes. I have worked with a lot of musicians in my time and seen some grim behaviour. I think I mentioned once before on a podcast, Patti Smith constantly spitting all over the stage at the Roundhouse.
I've seen her spit before as well. She spat on the stage when she played at the Delawarr Pavilion.
Very unpleasant, and I feel particularly sorry for the poor people that have to come and clean up after her.
Absolutely, I'm not
spitting
sure
extravaganza.
I've a lot of time for Patti Smith, but cleaning up her spit is perhaps a bit beyond me, I suspect.
Seen a member of the Stranglers booting a member of the audience in the face in the Nashville pub in Oz Court.
Lovely.
This is very good. But being given the task of Chuck Berry's road manager for one of his incessant tours in the mid-70s, that took me to a new level of horror, really. I wasn't yet 20, and I think I was given the gig because everybody else in the company had turned it down, I'm sure. Everything you've heard about Chuck Berry, every awful trait, I saw it all over those couple of weeks.
Oh, dear.
We hired a UK backing band.
So when was this? Was this
75? January 75. We hired a UK backing band for him. He refused to rehearse or even soundcheck with them.
Right.
He simply expected them to know his songs. He had no set list. He just expected them to pick up whatever song he decided to play. Sometimes, like throwing a dog a bone, he would shout out the title of the next song. More often, he wouldn't bother. He demanded his fee in cash every night. You often read this in stories about him. It's absolutely true. He made me go to a shop and get some brown paper bags for each promoter to put the cash in, and then I had to show him the money. I had to physically show him the money each evening before he went on stage, and he was constantly angry because he couldn't figure out, no matter how I tried to explain to him, he couldn't figure out the difference between UK sterling and US dollars, so he kept thinking he was being ripped off. But
well,
I'm saying,
to be fair, he'd chuck the profit, given where we are now in terms of Brexit and exchange rates.
Or if it had been euros, God only knows.
Absolutely. I don't want to be fair. I could share Chuck Berry's skepticism over the euro.
I had to I'd give him the paper bag with the money and containing his fee, and he put it into a briefcase, which he guarded, absolutely zealously guarded this briefcase, because, of course, it had all the tour money in. And then either I, or the poor roadie, Wilf, I remember him to this day. Great name for a roadie, Wilf.
That is a good name for a roadie. I quite like that.
Yeah, he'd roadied for everyone. Literally from the Sinatra to Ducks Deluxe, I remember. He's everybody. We had to
Don't you be dissing Ducks Deluxe. They deserve a career like anybody
they
else.
Do. We had to stand at the side of the stage with a watch in our hands, and he used to keep glancing over us, make sure we were standing with a watch in our hands. the very second his contracted time on stage was up, which I, from memory I think was 45 minutes, he would wind up whatever song he was playing almost instantly, simply walk off the stage, straight out of the theatre, into a car, whisked him away, where he was always in the company of a tall blonde woman. So an absolutely dire couple of weeks, Jules.
It does not sound like a rewarding experience, really, or indeed something. I'm surprised you stayed on in the music business, really, because that would be enough to put anybody off, I should think.
I know, I was so naive. I mean, I was 19, and I'd been to an all-boys school. I just had one girlfriend, and you know, the things I saw. But you also have stories of musicians behaving badly.
Well, yes, most of mine. Well, so some of mine are kind of Riot Girl based, and I actually very much admired some of the Riot Girls. Much of it based around the word. You might remember. Some people might remember it's a TV show that was on Channel 4 in the early 90s.
Terry Christian.
Sorry?
Terry Christian presented it.
Absolutely, yes, and Katie Patrick. Yes. And it was very post-pub television, and parts of it were terrible, but it was remembered the fact that it used to have some amazing bands.
Mm.
And, for example, Nirvana, and again, bands behaving badly, Nirvana playing their first UK TV appearance, and the first words Kurt Cobain said on British television was, Courtney Love is the best, and then a word I can't say on a family podcast, in the world, and that's how they opened their performance. They were booked by a young booker called Joe Wiley.
Oh,
who worked in the booking office with her mate Zoe Ball.
Oh, good grief.
So one of the most memorable performances. So there was a band called L7.
Oh, right.
Who were an all-American, all-girl kind of Riot Girl band. Mm. Donita Sparks was one of the main movers behind them. And I can't remember how this came about, but they basically played with their pants down on the word and were censored quite heavily as a result. Some of the blocking that went place on that was a bit random, frankly. They had a habit of, you know, sort of genitalia-related misbehaviour. One of them also once removed a feminine hygiene product and threw it at the crowd at Red Bull. Quite badly behaved. Badly behaviour amongst award shows also I'm quite favoured. I can't find the exact quote, but I seem to remember Evan Dando of the Lemonheads being given an award for something, an NME Awards, I think, possibly in America, and proclaimed that he didn't want it and threw it into the nearest bin on his way back from the stage, which, you know, people complain about Bob Dylan not wanting to accept the Nobel Prize, but I quite enjoyed Evan Dando throwing it away before he'd even got back to his seat. The various, you know, badly behaviour Brit Awards, you know, speeches, people swearing, Liam Gallagher generally being Liam Gallagher, Adele famously flipping her little finger up when she was called off by James Corden from her speech. My favourite, I also enjoy, are rock stars bad? Or are they just misunderstood? Mm. I quite like rock stars behaving oddly as well as rock stars behaving badly. Bjork made a quick acceptance speech when she won Best International Female at the 1998 Brit Awards, which largely consisted of her running on stage shouting the word grapefruit and then leaving the stage, which, you know, when it comes to short speeches, people go on, don't they? And actually, I admire Bjork's brevity. PJ Harvey recording Rid of Me with Steve Albini over a week, during which allegedly she only ate potatoes. I quite like sort of food. Rock stars and food is possibly a different thing, and possibly the problem with these rock star behaviours, it's become apocryphal, hasn't it? You know, rock stars have to behave badly, as a result of which, you know, we hear things about Keith Moon driving a car into a swimming pool, and apparently he didn't actually. He reversed it into a bit of a swimming pool, we're told. Ozzy Osbourne allegedly once urinated on the Alamo.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Some Texans were so angry they launched into a mini riot at the concert. Actually, it turns out, well, there's good news and bad news on this. The good news is that Ozzy Osbourne didn't, in fact, wee on the Alamo, which is obviously a much relief. The bad news is that he did, in fact, relieve himself on a 60-foot cenotaph across the street.
Oh, God.
So I don't know if that makes things better or worse. So yeah, rock stars and bodily fluids is basically what I seem to have come up with, which is not an area in which I wanted to dwell. So apologies if anybody's now sort of had to have their dinner twice.
Two things about that. You talk about PJ Harvey just almost eating potatoes. Yeah. It just reminded me, my mother tells me a story. She goes out to lunch with one particular friend, bearing in mind that these are women in their 80s. And my mother will go out to lunch and she'll have, I don't know, you know, Dover sole and whatever, or, you know, pie of the day or whatever. Her friend only ever has a bowl of chips wherever they go. Whatever restaurant they go to, wherever they go in the home counties, my mother orders her there, and she knows what her friend is going to say. Oh, I'll just have a bowl of chips, please. It could be the Ritz, it could be Fred's Caff, but it's always a bowl of chips.
I bet the Ritz chips are really nice, though, to be fair.
I bet they are. I was at the Brits. I've only been to the Brits a couple of times, and I was there the year that Chumbawamba bloke dropped the iced water over John Prescott. No, I was saying about how naive I was in 1975, and I just one last incident on that Chuck Berry tour, the weirdest incident. I was very naive, very innocent. I had no idea of the ways of the world. I was a teenager, and don't worry if you're on the school run. I won't give graphic detail here, but he was in the dressing room in London before one of the shows. There were several shows in London, different venues, and suddenly he decided he wanted a cheese sandwich. Now, he kept saying to me and the promoter, I'm not going on without a cheese sandwich. In retrospect now, I realise he was trying to get rid of me. But off I went onto the streets of Lewisham. Why we'll be complaining in a moment. I went onto the streets of Lewisham. Got to remember, looking for a cheese sandwich in the mid-1970s, there was no Starbucks, there was no Pret. No. I went to a pub. I found a pub and I persuaded them to make a cheese sandwich, paid for it out of my own money, of course. He would never have given me the money. Back into the Odeon, into Chuck Berry's dressing room, where I found a different blonde woman from the one the previous night, undertaking a very personal service.
Oh, dear, okay.
On Chuck Berry. But the strangest denouement of the whole thing was, instead of shouting at me or stopping, he simply gestured me over to hand him the cheese sandwich, which he then happily ate while the blonde lady carried on regardless. No. So on tour with Chuck Berry, possibly the two most difficult weeks of my entire life. And it's been a long one.
I'll be looking at cheese sandwiches differently from now on as well.
all sports...
But where do we go from here, Terence? Well, how can we recover from this?
It appears we're going to Jethro Tull. All sports hierarchies treat us all with contempt. That's next after Juliet's rather unexpected selection, but very welcome, of Jethro Tull.
Thank you.
there were two things that brought me to choose that, which was Living in the Past by Jethro Tull. Firstly, recently, well, I think it was last weekend, it was Carole Kaye's 75th birthday, who was an eminent bass player. She doesn't play on that, but she was an eminent bass player. And
with the Wrecking Crew. She was in the Wrecking Crew.
And she played she played bass on, you know, all manner of everything. Amazing songs. But I think her achievement that's kind of seen as her crowning achievement is the bass line on Wichita Lineman, which I tweeted a thing about it last week. And it's the way that the bass leads in to the song, and the song is very much sort of rooted around the bass, I feel. And actually, I realised that it reminded me of Living in the Past, in that Living in the Past is very much bass-led as well, but not in a way like Another One Bites the Dust, but bass-led as in, you know, quite a tricky, almost sort of jazz type line. I mean, it's in some weird time signature, I presume, like 6/8 or 5/4 or something that I don't really understand. And the other thing, of course, is that given some of the proclamations that have been made over here in England about Brexit, and Article 50 was triggered this week, this was the song that seemed to float into my brain the most as a result.
We've specialised in bass-driven songs recently, because we had Stepping Out, didn't we, with Jackson the other week. Yeah, Jethro Tull were the very epitome of a group who would get mums and dads tooting at the screen when this very song was on Top of the Pops in 1969, and old Ian Anderson with his kind of like wild hair and his gurning at the camera, and his odd habit, I don't know if you've seen this in videos, the odd habit of raising one leg up in the air high off the floor when he was having a good old go on his flute.
Well, I was very much about to say it. Whenever you say that, I think of people playing the flute while standing on one leg. I admit that Jethro Tull are not the coolest band ever, but actually I found that on 7-inch when packing my record box last night, and thought, I don't think this is going to go in a busy bar, but I do really like this tune. I was sad to leave it behind.
One of the most enduring aspects of sport, particularly the mainstream ones, apart from their popularity, of course, is the manner in which the owners, hierarchies, governing bodies of these sports treat the supporters and followers of the sport with complete contempt. Using football as an example, club owners push the ticket prices as high as possible, despite the fact being that at the very top level, stadium income only amounts to about 30% of revenue due to the huge sums television companies now pay to cover the sport. And of course, those television companies also exploit all of us sports fans by charging massive monthly sums to watch football, elite football and cricket. And of course, double the contempt by staging games at 11:30 in the morning.
Absolutely.
Now, cricket seems to be joining the party with the announcement this week of a new tournament that will dominate summers to come, a 2020 setup with teams divided into regions rather than counties. So teams will be called the West Country, Birmingham, North London. Now, in football, it's easy. I was born about 3 miles from Chelsea's ground. My father carried me into Stamford Bridge before I could even walk. So, obviously, you know, that's who I was going to support. You support QPR for similar family background location.
My mum grew up a road away from Loftus Road, so yeah.
But can you really imagine, George, feeling feverish support for example, the South in this cricket, which is going to incorporate Kent, Sussex and Hampshire, sort of imposed loyalty?
Yeah, I have no desire to unite with Kent, I must admit. Having spent 3.5 years of my working life travelling between counties on a daily basis and feeling the need to issue my passport, there was literally a bridge that you drove over between the two counties. It just seems to be people messing about with sports, again, to make more money. That is always the motive, isn't it? And that is what is so maddening about it. I talked to my dad briefly about this the other night, and he said to me, well, you know how I feel, Juliet. For me, it was over the day they all started playing in pyjamas. And so it's a bit kind of, yeah, I agree with you. It does. It seems to be, people seem to tramp, in order to get, you know, more money, in order to monetize, that's the word you use now if you're a suit, isn't it? In order to monetize sports, there seems to be this trampling over of long adhered to traditions and people that kind of walk in with a tin ear for what actually makes sport. And the idea is the county championship is, you know, 100 years old. It's pretty old, isn't it? And the idea that, you know, we're now trampling all over that just seems to be ridiculous. And it reminded me, actually, in terms of owners behaving with contempt, particularly for sort of established kind of geographical boundaries, it made me think of the MK Dons debacle. And the idea that the owners of Wimbledon, or AFC Wimbledon, decided that they were going to move the club to Milton Keynes, which is just ridiculous, isn't it? This all stemmed from the idea that Wimbledon had constant problems with having a ground. They lost Plough Lane in the late 80s, early 90s. They were sharing at Selhurst Park with Crystal Palace for a while. And so rather than, you know, attempting to sort that out, the owners decided that they would just simply move it to Milton Keynes, as a result of which AFC Wimbledon then was kind of revived as a non-league team. And I believe that very recently MK Dons and AFC Wimbledon were in the same league, and it was seen as a kind of a victory for sort of real Wimbledon fans. Also made me think of the curious case of Cardiff City. They were taken over by Vincent Tan, and Cardiff City play in blue.
That's
they
right.
They are nicknamed the Bluebirds.
Bluebirds, yes.
Yes, they have played in blue for 114 years. You know, this is what they do. This is them. Vincent Tan came in and decided they were playing red.
Yeah.
And so he decided they'd play in red instead. And there were loads and loads of fan protests, loads of fan protests. And eventually, after 3 years, this is my favourite ever statement, Vincent Tan, to his credit, changed his mind. And I think that his statement is worth reading in full. In a statement, Mr. Tan said, "The Christmas and New Year period has given me time to reflect on events of the last year. Spending time with my family had a profound effect on me. My mother, Madame Lo Su Beng, a devout Buddhist who attended Cardiff City Football Club to watch them play," I want to have Cardiff a big amongst the Buddhist community, "anyway, spoke to me on the importance of togetherness, unity and happiness. Cardiff City Football Club is important to me and I wish to see it united and happy. With the guidance and influence of my mother, I asked my chairman, Mehmet Darman, and the chief executive officer, Ken Chu, for their advice and to consult with a good cross-section of the fan base. This meeting took place last night when some 70 representatives of our supporters were present. I am informed that this was a very productive and frank exchange of views, but with all the same objectives to strengthen our club. These views were also added to by a large number of emails that were sent to the club over the last 24 hours from our wider supporter base. To paraphrase John F. Kennedy, let us never compromise out of fear, but let us never fear to compromise." I have to say,
that's rather sweet.
As much as I was annoyed by Vincent Tan coming in, you've got to love anyone who quotes John F. Kennedy and their mother as their main reasons for changing their mind. So, yes, it annoys me when owners will not compromise. But perhaps, you know, let us all follow the example of Vincent Tan and give in to, not exactly give in, but listen to fan pressure and realise that perhaps you've made a mistake and deal with it gracefully.
Well, you know, you mentioning sort of this movement of teams there, because it makes me realise, you know, we're becoming, of course, like America, with teams becoming franchises. And it's very telling that you say this at this particular week, because my favourite American football team were in the 1980s. I'm in love with Los Angeles. So the Los Angeles Raiders were my team. Just on a whim, the owner's whim, they upped and moved and they became the Oakland Raiders in San Francisco.
I recall this, yeah.
But then this week comes the news, literally this week, that they're moving yet again. They're, from next season, they're going to be the Las Vegas Raiders.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Which, you know, just... it's extraordinary. How could you ever support a team in that fashion? Because either you've got to move house, or you've got a like 800-mile round trip to go and support your team, or effectively, as the Milton Keynes people did, you know, you have to start over. It's absolutely ridiculous.
And that's the nub of it, isn't it, really? And also, it goes to this idea that people that treat football clubs and sporting clubs as cash cows, if they're not rooted in the sport, if they haven't grown up as sports fans, I mean, people like Bill Kenwright has been, you know, has been great at Everton because he is genuinely a football fan and therefore understands it. People that inevitably come from either business or the entertainment industry, I think they make the mistake of thinking, you know, if you build a theatre and put stuff on, people go, don't they, to watch. If you put gigs on, people go to watch it. And I think people in that position, they don't realise that football clubs and sports clubs and supporting a club traditionally for geographical areas, like you say, is a tribal thing.
Yes.
And you know, and people will support, you know, I'm sure that both of us have sat through all manner of rubbish at our respective football clubs, that we have paid good money to see bad things, and yet we continue to do so because we support that club and we are emotionally tied to it. And yet they seem to think, oh, well, it doesn't matter if I move my football club from one end of the country to the other. It doesn't matter if I move my sports team across continents, because there are still people there that want to watch sports, so they will come. And I think they mistake. They think that, that sports consists of casual observers in a way that perhaps some of the entertainment industry does, which perhaps it does sometimes. I mean, you know, if I really like football to the extent where if there is a football match on BT Sport, I'll have it, you know, I'll just watch it, you know, I'll have it on in the background because I just quite like the sport of football. But I think that, you know, these owners are mistaken, because then, of course, you give away the loyalty of people that will go bloody-mindedly to watch your team, no matter how rubbish they are, and replace them with casual people that may or may not wander along from one week to the next, depending on what they're doing.
And the hospitality people, of course, who go along for the sandwiches and
yes,
the champagne.
And watch about 40 minutes of the game.
Yes, exactly. By the way, that move to Las Vegas hasn't got a big enough stadium to host the NFL football. So they're building one, $2 billion. That's all.
Absolutely. But, and also not the best conditions to play football. I've been to Las Vegas, but I have. And it's in the Nevada desert. And the clue is in the name. It is extremely hot.
I suspect it'll be indoors. Surely it'll be an indoor dome like the Astrodome. Surely.
I can't imagine playing football outside. It's a clean heat, so it's mosquito free. But yeah, it's. To be honest, my capacity to run up and down and be knocked over in the manner of American football is not great anyway in normal conditions, never mind, you know, in stinking heat.
One last thing that amused me on this report about this cricket, much of the mood for radical change was prompted by a survey the cricket authorities carried out, and that there's a video package that the people at Lords were presented with that shows young people being interviewed about cricket, and that they
this cannot end well.
It won't end well. There's a young lad, you know, saying, oh, yes, Andrew Strauss, yes, he's a football manager, isn't he? And the best one of all, young people shown photos of Alistair Cook. More than one of them said, oh, does he work in Waitrose? Because he was wearing a Waitrose-branded top. So just to show other young people don't get cricket at all. But when...
Well, having said that, that is, in a way, I have some sympathy for the young people there, because that is quite, I suspect, an unwittingly sharp commentary on what happens when England cricket ties themselves up with commercial organisations.
Absolutely, yeah, there you are.
It wasn't the intent of the statements made by the young people, but that has made me smile, I must admit.
Absolutely. John Lydon has been back in the news this week. Is he a much loved maverick giving a metaphorical black eye to the establishment, or has he been wearing the Emperor's new clothes for 40 years? That's next after the Supremes.
Together.
I was driving back through the Surrey Hills on Monday afternoon, had my Spotify daily mix going, and that Ace track from the Supremes popped up as the sun was sort of lighting up the North Downs. It was lovely. From 1972, Diana Ross had left to go solo, so this was Mary Wilson and Gene Terrell sharing the lead vocals. But amazingly, I mean, if one didn't know that, you'd still think, well, that sounded just like Diana Ross, because...
Absolutely, yeah.
They were still heavily influenced by that sort of breathy, sighing nature of Diana Ross's style of singing. Great song, written by Smokey Robinson, and that fantastic bass line again, Jules, great bass line by James Jamerson.
Absolutely agree. To reference your driving over the North Downs, again, geographical rivalries, being as I live on the doorstep of the South Downs, so shout out to the South Downs Massive.
So that was the Supremes, and automatically... Sunshine. Now, extensive research shows, Jules, that the most popular part of this podcast is when you reveal your upcoming engagements for your public. We need to know.
Thank you very much. I was playing last night. I DJed out at the Printworks Venue in Hastings. That was immensely enjoyable, hence why this podcast has been scheduled for slightly later in the day. I don't have any DJing gigs this week. I'm looking forward to going to see the Jesus and Mary Chain play next week in Bexhill. That will be excellent.
Must make a note for you to... You must tell us about that next week.
Yes, I will do. I'd love to chat about that. It's next Thursday as well. So we'll do our on-air admin and say I can't do Thursday. I'm not doing the Saturday Social this evening because it's our week off, but we will be back next week. I will do Indie Wonderland, however, next Wednesday. I'll be unveiling my new track of the month. It will be barricaderadio.com. I'll be there from 8 until 10 on a Wednesday evening doing Indie Wonderland. And actually, as I said, be back announcing my engagements now. I spoke at something in Eastbourne on Thursday night called the Barvard Bar, which is something that someone I know called Tim is putting on upstairs at a lovely venue called the Printer's Playhouse. And I did an extended version of my Petch Cooch talk that I spoke about last week. I did a 15-minute version, stood at a lectern with a microphone, feeling like I was giving a TED talk. but it was the video will be up at some point, apparently, so I will try and post that up on my Twitter.
Oh, I look forward to seeing that. Maybe, again, you'll dismiss my entire career in a sentence.
Is an extensive examination of your career, because as I announced at the beginning, I was told off last time. We go into it in some detail.
I'm delighted to hear it. Quite a fair bit of music from the original punk era of 76, 77. I have to say, I don't believe it's travelled very well.
It's not dated brilliantly.
It hasn't. There's some noble exceptions. London Calling, the track London Calling still sort of shivers up my spine 40 years on. But these days, nobody listens to the Sex Pistols or plays them on the radio. And let's be honest, John Lydon, Johnny Rotten, just got lucky and spread a very thin talent over a very wide canvas. And do you know what? Just listening back to his singing style, it always makes me think of a petulant teenager. And in fact, I always think if you add the words, "Oh, Mum," to any Sex Pistols lyrics, you'll see what I mean. Because, "Oh, Mum, I don't want a holiday in the sun." If he said, "Oh, Mum," in all of his Anarchy in the UK and Pretty Vacant, I think it would just add...
"Oh, Mum, I am an Antichrist."
Exactly. All of which hasn't stopped John Lydon popping up on breakfast TV sofas, Guardian features every couple of years when he has something to promote. Currently, it's the oddly titled Mr. Rotten's Songbook. It's a limited edition that's already sold out, actually. It's 1,000 print run at £300 a go.
From the kind of punks that now make a killing working in advertising agencies in their mid-50s, I suspect. Indeed.
So, therefore, a handy £300,000 brought in there. I'm not, as you can tell, much of a fan, and he's not from your era at all, Jules, but for you, is John Lydon a punk icon to be cherished?
He's that man that flogs butter, as far as my generation is concerned, I'm afraid. He appeared on I'm a Celebrity, didn't he?
Self-importantly,
and look at me type swore on air, used the C-word. Poor old Anton Deck had to mop that up. I very much like the Nevermind Sex Pistols album. I think it is a great record if you listen to it as a whole record. I mean, it's, you know,
as a history, a document of history more than for its musical merit. Is that what you mean?
Well, no, I actually quite like it on musical terms. I don't think, I mean, it is nothing, I mean, Sex Pistols always pale in comparison to The Clash, and they suffer greatly because they both emerge at the same time. And obviously you have very personal links to The Clash, but I have been an enormous Clash fan for years and years and years. My first introduction to The Clash, being not of that generation, I was bought from Here to Eternity, their live album, Best Of, for Christmas, about 2000, I think, or 2001. It was not long before Joe Strummer died, actually. And I thought it was great, and I really, really liked The Clash. And London Calling is just, you know, an iconic album. So if you're going to compare, you know, Nevermind to that, then obviously it's always going to pale. But I do like it. I quite like to put it on a sunny day whilst I'm doing some washing up or something. I do actually quite enjoy listening to it from start to finish. I think in John Lydon's defence, I'm no great fan of John Lydon either, particularly Johnny Rotten / John Lydon. I just think he's a wind-up merchant who's made an awful lot of money, like you say, on a not equal amount of talent. I do think that PIL did some quite interesting stuff. So the Public Image Limited and all that kind of stuff. But having said that, I wonder how much of that was him and how much of that was Keith Levine and Jar Wobble, frankly. I think the more might be credited to them. I just find him to be tedious, really. And actually, we've talked about whether or not I am a Generation Xer or a Millennial or Generation Snowflake. I'm a very, very old Millennial, I think. I think I'm just about young enough to be a Millennial. I'm kind of falling between Generation X and Millennial. I'm in a very fortunate position, and I do, you know, I say I own my own property. Most of it belongs to the bank, but I do own my own property, and I do have a good job, and I own well, and I have a relatively happy life compared to some. I'm established compared to a lot of people my age. I'm 32 who aren't, and we talked about that before in the podcast. But even so, given that, you know, thinking about it the other day, I am likely to be working into my late 70s, I would predict, probably, even with careful management of money. My state pension age is 70 now, I think. And you know, I can't, you know, there are people that I know that will be working way into their 70s, I suspect, and beyond. And part of me doesn't want to get involved in these kind of baby boomers versus millennial wars, because I do think that, you know, without sounding a bit tinfoil hat, I do think that they are divisive and designed to divide people, and I don't like that. But equally, this is one of my frustrations with quite a lot of Jeremy Corbyn supporters. Contrary to what people think, they're not young people. They're rich, kind of hamster dwelling, but, you know, they're rich liberal people that had the best out of the state, I feel, that had free education, that, you know, were able to go into jobs. I know that they didn't have it all easy, and David Hepworth wrote a really good piece on his blog once about this, but equally I do find it a bit much when people that really did have the best of British society, like Johnny Rotten, who have got fat off not a lot of talent, who are now in quite a privileged position, like you say, selling £300 books to you know, fellow punks. That it's almost like the hippie generation, isn't it, really? Fellow punks that now work in advertising. That's one of my reasons why he winds me up so much, because I don't think he's got very much as interesting to say. I feel he's like Morrissey in a way. They say things in a kind of a look at me type way to be contrary, and I just feel that, you know, they're desperately still trying to be quote unquote young, aren't they, whilst being controversial, whilst having no understanding of you know, the actual serious structural problems that young people are experiencing now, really. And when you compare it to, you know, the Omama problems that he was experiencing, as you say, in the 70s, I do have a problem with it. I don't have a lot of time for it. I think it's a bit pathetic, really.
Beautifully put, I must say. And to say that I attended the last Sex Pistols gig in the UK is probably overstating. It was December 77, Brunel University in Uxbridge. My girlfriend and I, we got there late as our car broke down in Slough. It was always breaking down, and it was generally in Slough that it broke down for some reason.
Just Slough's enough to make anyone break down.
I think that's probably a lot to do with it. We joined about 50 or so other part-time punks outside the sports hall. Couldn't get in. Imagine this, in health and safety today, what the students' union had done to try and stop people trying to sort of break into the gig, because the hall was full. They'd taken all the furniture out to get more people in, but they piled all the furniture up at the door of the sports hall. So you it was like a barricade, like the French Revolution. And we heard a few songs. We stood outside, essentially, with about these 50 other people, heard a few songs Sex Pistols set. The noise had to come through the furniture as well. And it was just simply a noise. You know, one sees the sanitised version in the odd video clip or Top of the Pops or whatever. It was just 3 minutes of throbbing caterwauling, followed by a shambolic pause, and then more of the same. It really did feel like the end, and it was. But since then, John Lydon has formed a career out of a sort of complicit media, I think, eager to kind of portray him as a bad boy with things to say. And it rather feels as though these views are designed to be controversial. And this week, he's made more rather simplistic statements on the breakfast TV sofas praising Donald Trump. And he described Brexit. He's been saying, oh, you know, all in favour of Brexit. He says, quoting, "The working class have voted and I support them. Let it be a nice exit, a truly British exit." That's what he said, Jules.
Well, it shows, you know, really that he talks about the working classes. Even if John Lydon was ever working class, I think, again, you could talk about, you know, whether or not you move between classes, whether that's a thing. But the idea of him being, again, I keep thinking of Morrissey when I think of him, because I keep thinking, well, even if you did once come from an ordinary background, you are so disconnected now from what is actually happening. I can't imagine if you are flogging books at £300 a time, I don't think that quite equates to being a single parent on a 0 hours contract with a minimum wage job. You know, I find it to be, and you know, I'm not just saying this because I don't agree with Brexit. I'm not saying this because I disagree with him politically. I just find these kind of, like you say, these attention state seeking, ill-informed kind of statements just to be a bit, you know, a bit kind of tedious. And I'm not saying it's ill-informed because I disagree with it. It's just, they're just trite slogans, aren't they, really? And I think that's how I feel about him. He's just, you know, trite and you know, wants to be looked at. And this idea that it's almost sort of desperation. I'm still the working man. I'm sorry, but you're not. You can't tell me you are, because you're really, really not. At least, you know, I dislike this kind of liberal elite being flung round as an insult. And I suppose if we are going to fling it round, I am liberal elite. I did go to Hampstead the other day for a Labour Party thing. So yes, that doesn't get more. Even the cup of tea and bacon sandwich I had in a local caf meant that I was still liberal elite. It didn't stop me from being liberal elite. But equally, I don't know that insult being flown around, but equally, you know, I had the self-awareness to realise that, you know, I care very much about, you know, everybody having a better life, but I wouldn't necessarily argue I have to make an effort to tap into views of people that, you know, come, you know, have very difficult lives. And I, unfortunately, self-awareness is not something that I think Johnny Rotten has ever been particularly blessed with. And I think equally, the fact that he's so indulged by the media, like you say, you know, he's indulged by other white men in the media, because these things are still by and large run by white men, and that's why we are where we are.
He lives with his wife Nora in a house off Venice Beach, just out, yes, you know, in
very,
Los Angeles.
Very connected to the working
well,
people.
You know, which is great. Embrace that, Johnny, by all means. But then don't try and portray yourself as the voice of the displaced.
Yeah, exactly. In a way, I dislike the fact that politicians are made to jump through hoops with the price of milk test and whatnot. But equally, it is a useful signifier as to how connected you are to the real world. And somehow, I can't see Johnny being able to queue up for a pint of milk. I can't imagine that ever happening.
And our closing track, Jules, I think very much typifies this point.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love this. So I did a listener's request special on my Indie Wonderland show a few weeks ago, and someone said, oh, can you play some Denim? Denim were a 90s Britpop outfit. They were one of the original five on the select kind of cover that launched Britpop. Not necessarily seen as, they didn't go on to be one of the big bands. I think Saint Etienne were on that cover as well, and they're not really Britpop at all. So it's run by Lawrence, who was a chap that started off in Felt and then brilliantly became Denim. He was also Go-Kart Mozart as well. There's been a film made about him. He's a kind of an alternative kind of cult figure, really. And I can't help but like him. He always has these grand plans that never really go anywhere, but he's made some fine records. And this Denim track reminds me of a protest sign that I saw a picture of from the recent March for Europe, which took place in London last weekend, and someone waved a large felt tip sign that said, "But how will we win Eurovision now?" And lots of us have this as a legitimate concern, and this is actually written as a kind of a satire, I think, on the Eurovision Song Contest. And I think it's a great tune, and also sums up how I feel. So this is Denim, and this is My Song for Europe.
Here is my song for Europe. All you judges beware, here is my song for Europe. Little girls everywhere,
You have been listening to a Dacom Media production.